No, there's more. Om Gyanati Mirandhasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Nilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Nama Shrishtam Manamapi Shachiputra Matra Surupam Rupam Tasyagrajam Urupurim Mathurim Goshtavatim Radha Kundam Girivaramaho Radhika Madhavasham Prapto Yasya Pratita Kripaya Sri Gurum Tam Natosmi Vandeham Sri Guru Shriyatav Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagarna Raghunatanvitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shivishakanvitamscha Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Can women be in the mode of goodness? I heard that it is not possible and that they should be guided by a man who is in the mode of goodness. There is a purport by Srila Prabhupada like that. I don't have it in the... I don't have it... what's that? By heart? What's the term? Off by heart. I don't have it exactly. There is a purport in which Srila Prabhupada, probably following one of the previous acharyas, as many of Prabhupada's purports are, stating that generally women are guided by the mode of passion, many desires, and that if they're guided by a man who's in the mode of goodness, that they can also come up. In general, as you may have noted, women don't get a very good rap in the scriptures. It's considered a lesser birth than a male birth. In human form is the best, but the female form, Srila Prabhupada writes in the second canto, the female form is especially for deluding the man away from the project of self-realization. However, there is hope yet. Actually, there are many such quotes. Many said there is the king Sudyumna becomes a woman, cursed to become a woman. And then we don't find out about any women being cursed to become a man. He was cursed to become a woman, and then his citizens weren't very happy, so he had 1 month a woman, 1 month a man. He got it mitigated like this. Yeah, on the whole, it's not very, as the female form is not considered very suitable for self-realization. However, getting back to the however, Krishna consciousness is, it jumps over, especially Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's presentation of Krishna consciousness, jumps over all intermediate stages. Otherwise, none of us would have any opportunity to even think about or discuss such topics. So the woman, or the jiva within the female body, who by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya takes directly to Krishna consciousness, can, like the male within the fallen body, jump over all lower stages and immediately comes to this spiritual platform. So it might be difficult for them to be in the mode of goodness, as indeed it's difficult for anyone in the modern age to be exclusively in the mode of goodness, but by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy we can jump up to the stage above and beyond that, Shuddhasattva. Okay, all right. Okay, I answered one of yours, and then I'm going to. The disciple should always take the order of the guru. That's not exactly what was stated. I quoted, here it's stated that the disciple should always take the order of the guru. But the quotation that I gave from Chaitanya Charitamrita, which was quoted from Raghuvamsa, which is a poem by, who is that by? Bhavabhuti? Raghuvamsa? Look it up. Bhavabhuti, or I believe it is. Anyway, or Kalidas, one of the famous poets. And then there's another one directly from the Ramayana. So the point is that one should follow it without considering. One shouldn't stop to, is it right or wrong? One should simply follow it. Should always take the order of the Guru in one sense, but in another sense, it's not that one needs specific orders all the time. The general, for instance, the general order is there, rise early, snana kritya means bathing and everything else that goes along with it, such as evacuating, cleaning the teeth, and so on. So that's a general order. So you don't need an order every single day that what should I do? So general life goes on in general, under general orders. Then the question here is given, what happens when one does something without realizing the need to approach? What do you mean? You do something and afterwards you think, I should have asked about that first? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I'll explain in the book.
Okay, I'll read it on. We used to see everyone worship Prabhupada deity, so we did it. We were given shalagram by friends, and we worshipped them without asking. We thought they cannot be left without puja. When you came and saw them, you did not say anything, so we continued our worship. After Prabhupada Deshmukh came out, we realized we should have asked you. Oh, I see. I don't remember seeing you with shalagram and not worshipping then. What to do in these circumstances? There's, as a general reply, I would say there's a lot of training needed in our society because a lot goes on. Devotees just do things. They don't know what they're doing or why they're doing or how they should do it. Case in point, it's very common that people, especially in India, I don't know what it's like here, they start coming to the temple, they take some interest, and immediately someone goes and installs deities in their house. They have no idea about the philosophy of worshipping deities or how they should do, what the standards are, and there are the deities sitting in their home, and or someone gave them to me, so they feel obliged to worship, but they don't have the commitment to do so, or the knowledge to do so, and so their deity worship is at a very poor standard, or they have no idea of it. Actually, there are any standards. And often, I've seen in many places, the deities, they look like they haven't been bathed in months. The television is obviously much more central to the home than the deities. So establishing this culture, there's a lot of training required. But what's going on is that we want to bring more and more people in. It is troublesome to train others, to say again and again, this should be done, to show them, to train. And so we tend to, or there, as I see it, there is a tendency to bring others in and not. Or what happens is those who are not trained, they're also sent out to preach. And the wrong standard or the non-standard becomes standard. And so these things go on. So generally one should, in general we require a lot more training in our society, which I'm, for many of these points, I have actually already written hundreds of pages on Vaishnav culture and behavior, details of all these things, but I have to organize it. I really need more time to write. That's why almost everyone who's coming to see me says, please come here, please come there, please come and visit us. In many cases, I may not say directly, but I'm not going to, because I need time to write also. The books will be a more important contribution in the long term. But of course, writing the books is only just putting the knowledge out there, then others have to follow. But there are many, gradually there are devotees who are interested to follow all these things. Then we have another whole class of devotees who think, all these rules, what do you need all these rules for? No one ever taught me the rules. And they think to have practically no rules is the norm. So what do you do in such a situation? Then you rectify. Then you ask what to do in that situation. Follow the Guru's order. What happens if the order is too difficult to follow? If the disciple is asked to remarry, my friend became a widow when she was a child. Her family guru once asked her to remarry. She is from a community where widows do not remarry. Does she need to give up her guru or does she need to disobey? Difficult question. Generally, in India, since the British time, one of the social reforms they wanted to drive through was the helping the widows. First of all, not to get burned, and then to get remarried, especially if they're young. It was very common in those days. Girls would be married at the age of 5 or 6, and deaths were quite common from various diseases like smallpox and so on. So they'd grow up to learn that they're a widow, and they'd have to remain like that. So the British, they strongly, this is wrong, we have to reform, and they push this widow remarriage. But there are still communities who, in India, who are very much against that. Actually, according to the Dharma Shastras, some of the Dharma Shastras, it's allowed under certain conditions. For instance, if a girl is married as a child and her husband dies before the marriage is consummated, and in some cases, even if it is consummated, but she has no children, generally, if she has children, it's not allowed. but then there may be so many Indians also think, no, they think that all the old rules are wrong and bad, and widows should be remarried. But then here we have a case where the girl, being raised in that culture, doesn't want to remarry, but her guru wants her to. Tough question. Guru api avatasya karya karya majanataha utpanna pratipannasya parityago vidhiyate. That example is there. Bhishma rejected his guru, and it seemed that his guru, it didn't seem to be such a bad order. He ordered that this, actually from the point of view of dharma, it would seem that Parashuram's order to Bhishma to marry was quite reasonable. Because what about the girl? She wanted to marry another man, but he had kidnapped her for the sake of his brother. But in the meantime, what happened? His brother died. And so she said, well, I want to marry you then. You took me, and now I'm your responsibility. He said, no way, I took a vow never to marry. And then she went to Parashuram, and he said, his guru, and he ordered, yeah, you should marry her. You should take responsibility for her. And Bhishma said, no, I took a vow not to marry. So he took he took the vow not to marry to be more binding than the order of the guru to protect this woman. And he fought with him and defeated him. And he, on these grounds, that the guru should be rejected. In this case, in this particular case, I would... it may not be either or. It might be that the members of the community, the elders of the community, would speak to the guru. It doesn't have to be either or. They could maybe speak to him and convince him. If he's adamant on that point, that she must remarry, and she's the community don't want her to, and it puts her in a very difficult situation, obviously. Because if she does remarry, then her family, her birth family, the whole community will reject her. And who's she going to marry? Because she can't marry within that community, and usually people marry within their community. So I would say, try to convince the guru. Or the guru can try to convince the community to change their custom or to make an exception. And if there's still no way, then maybe she would continue to worship her guru in a somewhat distant way. That can also be. That's a suggestion. It does happen. We've seen within our ISKCON society that sometimes the disciples become distant from the guru. Not that he's fallen down in terms of behavior, not breaking the regulated principles, but over some philosophical or behavioral reason. It may be. It may happen. Question number 2 from Bhagavati Mataji. Varnashram dharma is necessary out of compassion for those in the modes of nature, almost everyone. Preaching about varnashram dharma is mixed with the modes of nature. So how is such preaching elevating? Surely it is better to preach absolute facts. Preaching about varnashram dharma is mixed with the modes of nature. Not necessarily. Srila Prabhupada preached about it, but his preaching wasn't mixed with mundane considerations or mundane consciousness. Yeah, mundane considerations, yes, because when we're talking about varnashram dharma, we're talking about mundane considerations. But his preaching wasn't mixed with the with mundane consciousness. So how is such preaching elevating? Surely it is better to preach absolute facts. That might seem to be correct, but then just consider that Srila Prabhupada himself preached so much about it. So if we insist that preaching about varnashram, we shouldn't preach about varnashram, we should preach absolute facts, then indirectly, not very indirectly, we're saying that Srila Prabhupada was mistaken and by preaching about this. Absolute facts, yeah, that's the thrust of our preaching, but establishing varnashram dharma is, or attempting to establish varnashram dharma is meant to create a system and an atmosphere in human society and among devotees also that helps to sustain them in Krishna consciousness. It's not Krishna consciousness directly itself. About mundane things, we could say, well, we find Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we find in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the elevated Shastra, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu instructing Rupa Goswami about what? Well, Krishna Prema, the activities of Krishna with the gopis in Vrindavan, and other things like cleaning the teeth. Look it up, it's right in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Danta Dhavana is among the activities that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spoke to Goswami about the daily duties of a Vaishnava. So that's not very spiritual. You're not going to, by cleaning your teeth, you're not going to go back to Godhead. So why did Chaitanya Mahaprabhu say it? Well, if we don't clean our teeth, then some bad smell is likely to come from the mouth. That'll be offensive in worshipping the deity. We're likely to get oral diseases, dental diseases, which will be a distraction. And even in preaching, if there's bad breath, people will be turned off. So it's a practical consideration. It's a very simple practical consideration. Varnashram dharma is not in and of itself elevating, but it is meant to help devotees and others from grossly degrading, because man is a social animal, as the saying goes. Srila Prabhupada also quoted it. We have to have some kind of social system, so Krishna's social system is the best. For more enlightenment about this, please read Srila Prabhupada's conversation about Varnashram, in which he spoke in 1974 in Vrindavan, in which Srila Prabhupada was stressing we should establish Varnashram, and his disciples, quoting arguments that he himself had given them previously, said, well, isn't that mundane? Aren't devotees above that? And Srila Prabhupada said, well, aren't devotees above the modes of nature? And Srila Prabhupada said, well, if they're above the modes of nature, why are they falling down? So please read that. Number three, Srila Prabhupada's disciples have different moods in passing on his message. How to deal with the variety of opinions? Very good question. It is confusing, especially for new devotees, what to say to them. It's inevitable that there will be, that it is the philosophy or the understanding of Krishna consciousness that different people are different. We are different. We're not all the same. We're not all one. Variety of opinions. If there are different opinions, then we should come to discussion based on Srila Prabhupada's statements, his statements, and also in light of a guru, sadhu, and shastra. He always taught us to see via guru, sadhu, and shastra. Even then there'll be different outlooks, but it should be discussed on this basis. I have proposed several times to various leaders of our society that as Srila Prabhupada, he suggested or advised, is a better word, advised his disciples to study the Roman Catholic Church for the matter of organizing ISKCON. Not that we're going to be exactly like that and have bishops and things like that. But Srila Prabhupada considered it to be very well organized, which is one of the reasons why it's still going on after 2,000 years. It's quite an achievement, isn't it? Of course, the Roman Catholic Church, as it's known now, didn't exactly start right after the departure of Jesus, but it's been going on for hundreds of years, and it's still a very solid, prominent, and influential institution. So we can learn from that. So one of the things I've suggested, not that it was my original idea, but I've suggested several times to various leaders of our society, is can we have orders within ISKCON, as there are orders within the Catholic Church? Orders means there are different groups of monks, nuns, and priests. Very most prominent are the Jesuit order, also Franciscan orders, and there are many, many others. Trappist, Mill Hill, Society of Vincent de Paul, that's more for lay people. They all have their own different take or different flavor. But they're allowed to do that, but they all swear allegiance to the Pope. So they have different things. Franciscans started off following St. Francis of Assisi with the vow of poverty. But even within his lifetime, they started building big monasteries, which he was against. So his own mission was thwarted. In the beginning, Jesuits, they arose largely to rescue Catholicism from the onslaught of Protestantism and Lutheranism. So different. Vincent de Paul, the society, they put a lot of emphasis on social welfare work. So different. Trappist, also called Cistercian, they're very monastically. They're not so much outgoing, but they monks and nuns, and they put a lot of emphasis on prayer, not so much social work, but prayer, rising early. They used to be completely vegetarian, now they've become somewhat compromised on that. So the different flavors and approaches. So I've suggested several times, and it seems that the GBC is looking into that now, researching that. I just received an email from a devotee who I'm in correspondence with about this, and he said that the GBC members or whoever's acting on their behalf is investigating this from different perspectives. One is legal, that if we have different orders, how would that legally, how would the legalities of that say? Would it also be within ISKCON or not? Or would it be an affiliate, or what the legal issues? Another was philosophical. How far can you go? Just like, according to the GBC, it is forbidden within ISKCON to propagate that the jiva didn't fall from the spiritual world, although there are quite a few devotees within our movement who support that position. It's considered to be offensive to Srila Prabhupada. So would it be tenable to have an order within ISKCON that believed the jiva didn't fall from the spiritual world, when official GBC supported the official GBC position on this is that we did fall from the spiritual world, and it's considered offensive to Srila Prabhupada to have, according to that GBC resolution, to have a different opinion. So that's one concern. And there's one other which I can't remember. There was legal and philosophical. Maybe the other is administrative, or I can't remember. But there were three main considerations. So they are thinking, it would make it much easier if it was, at least as I say, it would make it easier if it's clear, okay, we're devotees, but we're following in this line. We're devotees and we're following in this line. Hridayananda Maharaj is spearheading Krishna West. And although I'm pretty much on the opposite pole when it comes to propagation of Krishna consciousness or attitudes within Krishna consciousness, I'm actually not against a lot of what he says. And actually within our society, we already do a lot of the things that he says. For instance, instead of trying to give people in the West prasadam of a style that they may not particularly like, Although I think in England, curry is one of the most popular foods nowadays, right? It's Indian. Indian cuisine has, in a generation, fish and chips has been relegated to the bottom of the league, and curry has come up, the chicken tikki has come up. Ooh, you know, chicken tikki. But anyway, there's some idea that people can relate. Actually, in India, it seems, the young people, if you go to the students, they love pizza. With lots of tomato sauce. Not very Vedic. although I heard one devotee say, actually, it's just a chapati. A pizza is just another form of chapati. And there is something like that. Naan roti. Have you seen that? It's baked in an oven and it's thick with white maida like that. So you could say a pizza is a Western form of naan roti. But naan roti, that's also in the Muslims mostly, isn't it? But they were Hindus previously. Is it Vedic or is it not? Okay. Is it bona fide to eat pizzas or not? So that's one thing. Dressing in Western clothes to make, if people feel more comfortable about that. I'm not wholly against that. I'd be very happy if by that, by making some cultural adjustments, you can make thousands and millions of people chant Hare Krishna and take Krishna consciousness seriously. I'd like to see it done. But we should also recognize the importance of Krishna's own culture. Because as far as we understand from the descriptions of Shastra, Krishna doesn't wear t-shirts and jeans. And if we got to go to the spiritual world, we're not going to be able to wear them either. There's a dress code up there. It's not that I'm completely against that. There can be a place within ISKCON for that, can't there? But it's not that it has to. It's not that everyone has to preach like that. There can be varieties also. So it would make it clear if there's a demarcation of the varieties, then people come and says, well. You all dress in dhotis and saris, but over there they all dress in. I say, yeah, well, that's a different approach, that's all. That's all I have to say. Instead of saying, no, they're wrong, we're right. Number four. What do you think of the growing lobby in ISKCON that consider your preaching spearhead to be a threat to ISKCON's well-being and future? I would like to be clear how to proceed as I am surrounded by such, quote, devotees, unquote, in my current situation. Well, in my experience, I don't know if it's a lobby, but lobby means a group come together and try and influence the lawmakers. But my experience recently with all this hoo-ha about the banning and the unbanning of one of my books is that many devotees are very appreciative, and the ones who are not, I hardly received any feedback from them. I received a few days ago, someone wrote something that they didn't like it. But if those who think I'm a threat to ISKCON's well-being and future. Well, I haven't had anyone directly say that to me, actually. If I am, okay, let's discuss it. What is ISKCON's direction? What is our aim? What are we doing? If you think I'm a threat to ISKCON's well-being and future, why? Where are we going? Where are we supposed to be going? Why am I? You can discuss. But generally, I find that those who are so negative, they don't even want to discuss. They won't discuss. Or they just say, you're a fanatic. Which is just a way of saying, that, well, I don't agree with you, I can't say why. What's that? I've discussed this in my book on speaking strongly in Krishna consciousness. What is fanaticism? To speak strongly is not necessarily fanaticism. If we speak on the basis of Guru, Sadhu and Shastra, with a desire to uplift others, that shouldn't be called fanaticism. Rather, to reject someone just because you don't like their opinion, but you don't even want to justify it, that would seem to be closer to fanaticism. So if you can ask, why is it a threat to us? If anyone says to you that this preaching is a threat to ISKCON's well-being and future, you say, well, could you explain why? What is your vision of ISKCON's well-being and future? You can ask. Generally, if I do discuss about these things, I find that there are those who feel that they directly say that Srila Prabhupada's instructions, they don't work. Gurukul, we tried it, it didn't work, therefore reject it. Varnashram, we tried it, it didn't work, therefore reject it. Or leave it till later. Later means we'll always leave it till later. Then the next generation will also leave it till later. And the next generation after that will also leave it till later. Lack of faith. I would put it down to lack of faith in Srila Prabhupada's instructions. Just as Srila Prabhupada's own godbrothers didn't have faith that Krishna consciousness could be spread in the Western world. And even when Srila Prabhupada brought back devotees from the Western world, they said, well, they're not really devotees. They can't be devotees. They're right in front of them chanting Hare Krishna. They can't be devotees. They're from the West. Tradition, you see, all the devotees previously were Indian. So how can, see, they can't pronounce the Sanskrit properly. They can't be devotees. How are they devotees? Shoot, go hunting a rhinoceros, try to shoot a rhinoceros, Prabhupada said. Okay, that's the questions. Oh, are there more? Yeah. How to proceed when one can't ask the Guru at every step due to practical considerations? Is it better to get advice from others, to pray, to hope the Super Soul will guide us? How can we avoid being fruitive in preaching endeavors? How to proceed when we can't ask the Guru at every step due to practical considerations? Better in that situation to take advice from others. If there are others who we have access to, whose advice we respect, or who we hope to get proper advice from. Otherwise we can pray and hope the Super Soul will guide us. And generally in day-to-day activities, like I say, just getting up in the morning, do our regular activities, that doesn't arise. You yourself, the writer of this question, Bhagavati Dasi, has been in a situation recently. How would you describe that situation? There could be several adjectives. Any suggestions?
Difficult,
that's obvious, yeah.
It was undesirable. I felt like I was cornered in it.
You're cornered in that situation. And then you stood up. No one else stood up. You came out of the corner to stand up, and then you got boxed back again. Well, maybe not boxed back again, but a highly contentious situation. Probably, in hindsight, you wouldn't have maybe gone along with that. Maybe, I don't know.
I didn't see the alternative.
You don't see any alternative, yeah.
I would have liked to have
Well, now the now there's a strong lobby for making an alternative, although there was no interest prior to the kidnapping, as it's been labeled. There was no interest in that prior to that. Yeah, no one was coming forward previously, but now it's a fait accompli, and it's now everyone's become indignant and talking about how they've been serving them for 30 years. I went to Belfast so many times, I didn't see hardly anyone there serving. The service was... it was in Virahabhav, even though they were living just half a mile away, something like that. So it's a bit disingenuous on their part, insincere, it seems. And saying that the deities were brought to Leicester just for money, that doesn't make any sense, because you can get deities from anywhere. There are some good arguments on both sides, but anyway, how that was probably one of the most critical points in your life, one of the most intense situations you've been in, huh?
Because my husband was very strongly advising me to go through with it. The GBC was very very strongly advising me to go through with it,
and the deity worship.
The deity worship minister, face-to-face conversation with the global deity minister.
Did he come also, Nrisimha Kavachar Prabhu? He personally?
He came personally.
Murli Manohar, who's overseeing. Yeah. Question might be asked, why didn't they bring, because you told me in France the situation is much worse.
Yeah.
They could have brought deities from France. Why from, maybe easier because it's under the same GBC. Who is the GBC in France? Any idea? No. He's been retired from the GBC for a few years. I have no idea. No, he was a few years ago, but then he withdrew very, very soon, finding a belligerent attitude among the local divine. How can you have an English speaker as a GBC in France? That may be a factor also. The lack of love between the French and the English may spill over into Krishna consciousness also. Of course, Pragosha isn't English, but he's British. Is he? No, I don't know. Whatever he is, he's not French. He's not definitely not French. So I don't have a clue who the GBC is, actually. I wonder if anyone else does. This is going away from your question, but why there are many devotees in some parts of the world, and there are places, New Mayapur, disaster, tremendous property, a disastrous situation where the deity worship there is. Even Radha Madhav's worship in Belfast was severely substandard, but it's much worse, as you've told me, in New Mayapur. Why not send a whole team of... you said in Belfast sometimes pujaris come, but they don't stay. Well, why not send a whole team in? Why don't we work as a global movement instead of individual centre? All over Britain, there are places... Manchester, city of major importance in Britain. Okay, this is getting a little political now, but I think it's realistic. Why is the lack of interest from London side? What about putting some... Why is it that everything's concentrated at the manor? What about Manchester, Glasgow, Newcastle, Birmingham, Edinburgh? There was a centre in Edinburgh when Prabhupada was present. Prabhupada was very upset when it was closed down. What about spreading the Krishna consciousness movement in all these important cities? I mean, Britain, somehow or other, is still an important country in the world. I don't know exactly why, but it is influential. It is influential. Culturally, maybe due to the English language. Why not? Why think, as Srila Prabhupada said, think of the world first and your own zone second. So probably it wouldn't come to this why should this situation arise at all, that deities are being neglected year after year, there are centers in important cities which are just run down. Why is it? Why is it that our movements have been in a state of treading water at best for years and years in most of Europe and the whole Western world? Why is it like that? Sweden, so much more could be done. The whole of Scandinavia, nothing much going on in terms of Krishna consciousness. Finland was going well for quite some time, while Tatvavada Prabhu was the term president, and then for some reason or other, there was a coup d'etat against him, and I don't know what's going on there now. That's maybe a bigger question, a more important question than your own personal question. We could rephrase your question somewhat and say, how to function in a dysfunctional movement? I'm not deliberately trying to be political here, although I might be accused of doing so, but I'm just being realistic, that's all. You may or may not agree. And then it comes back to, what's that? The preaching is spoiling ISKCON or something like that. What was it? My preaching is a threat to ISKCON's well-being and future. Yeah, if I say things like that, I'll be accused of that. But really, I'm raising questions that are meant for ISKCON's well-being and future. If we think that ISKCON's well-being is simply to watch the most of the society just vegetate for years, and then is that for ISKCON's well-being, just to keep on smiling as the ship sinks? Well, it's not exactly sinking. Like I said, it's more like treading water. Treading water, you know what that means? You're going like you're not swimming anywhere, but you're just staying afloat. That's all. So it's like that. That's maybe a more important consideration overall. And those of you who are in London, I mean, it's London, Soho Centre has been vibrant for many years. They've had many good temple presidents there. Present temple president is a dynamic, advanced devotee. Even he, of course, you can't satisfy everyone in all respects, but overall, it would seem he's doing a great job there, and there have been others. Generally, town presidents at Soho Street, you'd think they wouldn't last long, but generally, whoever goes in there, they spend a few years. And it's been a vibrant center of Krishna consciousness for many years. Of course, it's very small. The manner, what's being done there is something amazing. The festivals and so many people coming. It's not that things are wrong as such in all, there's so many good things going on, but there is life outside of London also, which could be looked to and outside of the Gujarati community. The manor, the manor is largely Gujarati oriented, isn't it? Is it? Isn't it? Whatever. They've done, undoubtedly, they've done something, you know, how they've reached out and to the Gujarati community, the next generation. It's something very wonderful they've done, and we shouldn't minimize that. But when we see that within the same country, there's a center which is going on for years, substandard, couldn't there be some help? Even some financial help when there's so much money coming into the manor. Now, I'm not saying that what I'm saying is wholly correct, but it's an obvious question to ask. There may be reasons why the things are the way they are. There may be very good reasons why our movement in Britain is the emphasis is focused in London, and that doesn't, from the central leadership, there doesn't seem to be much interest in this area. When did the GBC last come to ISKCON Manchester? 2 years. Dayananda Swami, he's the traveling British sannyasi. He comes here regularly, is it? So that's some input is there. So, these are, at the least we can say, these are pertinent questions to ask. It's not that we have to start blaming everyone, but these are pertinent questions to ask. What is the plan for spreading Krishna consciousness widely in the whole of the United Kingdom? What is the plan? What's the program? We have manpower, we have resources, not so much in these small centres, but there is a lot concentrated in London. What about these small centres here? Doesn't Manchester require bigger centre expansion after all these years? Liverpool, a very important city, world famous city, thanks to the Beatles mostly, I guess.
Is it not down to the local devotees
though? Is it not down to the... Well, Srila Prabhupada also wanted local initiative. Maybe that's the answer given. But if the local initiative isn't able to pick things up year after year, and there is tremendous concentration of resources in one place, it would seem to make sense to for outside help to come, isn't it? It's a thought. Okay, I guess. Oh, that's it. Okay, that's all the questions. Any other hands up questions?
On these lines, if you could please a bit enlighten the philosophical meaning of the word movement in the Hare Krishna movement.
The philosophical meaning of the word movement in the Hare Krishna movement. I'm not sure if Srila Prabhupada had particularly philosophical thoughts when... I'm not even sure if he called it the Hare Krishna movement. It may have been his disciples. Although it came on every Back to Godhead magazine, the magazine of the Hare Krishna movement. It's an English word. Movement is generally used for political agitation, isn't it? Something like that. Or political, or some agitation for change in society. The animal rights movement. The idea is generally some group of people who indignantly want to make some change about something that they perceive is wrong. In Bengali, they often say the Hare Krishna Andolan, which is similar to movement. It means like a political organization. One thing is, we should always be moving. We shouldn't be stagnant. But philosophically, I don't. I, as far as I know, there's no indication that I know of to the contrary. Srila Prabhupada, he didn't invest any particular philosophical import to the word movement. Which means that there's not really much to say about your question. What's the philosophical import of the word movement in the Hare Krishna movement? Gives the idea of something dynamic, active. If you say Hare Krishna society, it might give the idea of something stagnant. Anything else? If not, we can chant some more bhajans. Yeah, please.
I want to get something on the soul in bacteria.
The soul in a bacteria virus. Yeah. Is a virus a living entity or not? Even the biologists, they themselves, they dispute among themselves. Maybe when the biologists sort it out, we could say whether it's a jiva or not. To tell you the truth, I don't know. Let's be honest. I don't know. How far down on the life forms is a jiva? If Sadaputa was here, I would ask him. But he's not. He's gone. Hopefully, back to Godhead. So, that's the kind of technical question that maybe when we've finished converting everyone in the world to Krishna consciousness, maybe that's the kind of question we could have our devotee scientists investigate. Why, are you afraid if you get the flu, you shouldn't take some antibiotics to kill the virus? Becomes an act of violence against the jivas. Should devotees take antibiotics? Kills bacteria, right?
Ayurveda.
Ayurveda, well, I presumably that also. There are Ayurvedic medicines for instance, expelling worms from the intestinal tract. So the worm, from the worm's point of view, that's violence. I want to stay here in this stool. Jivo jivasya jivanam. One living being lives on another. It's not possible to avoid some violence in this world. No, sorry, I must admit my ignorance. I don't know whether viruses are jivas or not. Sorry about that. That is something to do with your line of work, is it? You're in biochemical medicines, all this kind of thing.
Yeah, but between when they ask, we have to give some more understanding for them. That's when.
Well, if it's biological cell is generally understood to be a jiva, right? Each cell, Srila Prabhupada said, each one is an entity of in and of itself, right? So viruses are composed, at least the cells that comprise the viruses, they can be understood to be, each one is a jiva, which really, it's a lot of jivas. How many cells are in a human body? Any idea? Uncountable, practically.
Yeah, like 7 billion.
7 billion? That's all.
No, it's uncountable. We can't.
Well, 7 billion.
7 billion? There must be more than that. The number of people in the world is approximately 7 billion, but I would think, let's say, at least there are that many in a human body.
Yeah,
and that many cells, sorry, not humans. So,
doesn't consciousness determine?
If there's consciousness, but the cells, they do have some, they appear to have some level of consciousness, very low level of consciousness. Inconceivable.
Mountains also, I've heard.
What's that, sorry?
I've heard that mountains also.
Mountains, yeah, that's stated in Shastra. Even stones may have, in a very dormant form or covered form, consciousness, which means the jiva is there. That you can feel if you go in a forest, you can feel that there's life. Or if you big mountains, is it? Do you have that experience that there's some presence there? It's not just matter. Many people think that that just to be in nature like that is spiritual in and of itself. There are spirits in all cultures all over the world before the age of enlightenment or disenlightenment. It was generally, or definitely pre-Christianity, pre-Islam, it was accepted that every tree, every stream, every rock, the spirit is there. Life is everywhere. Anything else?
Cells from animals or body, we try to grow in the lab.
Right, genetic modification.
Yeah, multiply it, not just for genetic, to keep and go for experimenting.
Yeah.
Multiply it and preserve it.
Yeah.
So,
on the whole, this whole enterprise is rather demoniac. Taking cells from animals and putting them in other put some, what is it, some pig cells in a tomato or something like that. Fiddling around. The whole enterprise that we're going to improve on nature. Better take what Krishna has given us and work with that. They say they're making progress. Okay, so by the scientists' endeavor, smallpox has been largely eradicated. Now there are other diseases. By the laws of nature, if you so-called eradicate one disease, then other diseases will come up. They were supposed to have eradicated tuberculosis about 100 years ago, but now antibiotic-resistant strains are coming up again. One thing you can do in your laboratory, find a cure for the common cold. You're not able to do that, right?
Yeah.
It's miserable. When you get a cold, it's not, unless you go out in the Manchester rain with a cold, it's not a dangerous thing. If you go out in the rain, it may deteriorate into pneumonia, bronchitis, something like that. It's not a serious condition, but it's really miserable, isn't it, when you get a cold? But they can't do anything because the viruses are always mutating. They're always coming in different ways. That'd be a good thing to do, something rather than making bigger tomatoes with fish cells and things like that. And who knows what the effect of that's going to be? We don't know. They say, yes, it's scientifically found to be safe, but they don't know. Let's see in the course of time. You ever heard of thalidomide babies? You know about that?
Yeah, after some years.
Well, it wasn't very long. This thalidomide was used as a contraceptive, birth contraceptive, and then babies started getting...
Sleeping pill. It was used as a sleeping pill.
Was it? Oh, I thought it was used as a contraceptive. It was used as a sleeping pill, and then babies were born without arms and legs, thanks to this... safe drug. Maybe they're more strict in their safety. They're testing nowadays. But who knows? This is all Frankenstein stuff. Trying to manipulate the material nature in various ways. The whole idea is we'll make life better by our scientific manipulation. Human life is meant for God realization. No need for all this.
Actually, Maharaj, according to Ayurveda, some experts of Ayurveda say that there is no such concept as bacteria and virus.
No, there isn't in Ayurveda.
They said in Ayurvedic experts.
But it appears to make sense that there are bacteria and germs. For instance, when it was discovered that washing your hands, the doctor washing his hands after dealing with one patient, he should wash his hands before touching another. And just by that simple measure, so much disease was stopped. That's the history. There was one doctor in Vienna, I think, he was dealing with gynecology, maternity, and then so many women were getting diseases and they would die and their children would die. And then he just introduced this washing the hands, and then the number of deaths dramatically decreased. And people didn't believe it. He said there are germs on the hand. What germs? What are you talking about? So it would seem that at least from the point of view, practical point of view of modern science. But that is in there in Ayurveda also, isn't it? That you should keep clean. It's very much part of the whole culture. Yeah, Ayurveda is a completely different approach. The disease is an imbalance of the kapha, vata, and pitta. So the tridosha. It's a completely different approach. Whereas the Western medicine is based on the germ theory of disease. Diseases are caused by germs. They're not necessarily mutually contradictory. Chinese medicine with the acupuncture, that also works. It's also on another different, conceptual basis. It works.
Keshavananda Prabhu said that all this, whatever, medicines, it's all taken from Ayurveda.
All the medicines are taken from... Well, many of the... Most, I don't know about most, but many of the medicines, what happens is that the certain herbs are observed to have medicinal properties. It may be herbs, or it may be something taken in the goat's blood or something like this, used in a certain way, has certain medicinal properties. And then the pharmaceutical companies, they try to isolate the active ingredient and then they patent it. That's often how the treatments are made. The problem with that is that by isolating the active ingredient, they don't bring in all the other ingredients which are there, which modify the side effects and so on. Anyway, I'm definitely not an expert on medicine. You can ask Keshavanand Prabhu. Better you ask him. His opinion is that allopathy is all bogus. But it can be useful.
In emergency purpose. But actually,
Also there in Ayurveda, but they're lost. Surgery is there in Ayurveda, but it's largely lost.
Lost because of British invasion.
Well, yeah. Even malaria, if you have malaria, better to take your allopathic pills, which just stop it immediately. I had malaria many times. And many times I took the chloroquinine, but the after effect of that is almost as bad as the malaria. For about a month afterwards, you feel terrible because it it has a very bad effect on your liver. Then I was told some other medicine which they produced, which is actually much doesn't have that side effects. But then, after having malaria again and again and again and again and again, heavy malaria over several years, one devotee told me he'd been to see this, what's his name, Damodar Shastri, who treated Prabhupada. He's a Marwari doctor from Calcutta. He's passed away now. And he told him, you take Sudarshan Churna for 1 month, and it will kill the malaria within the system. It remains within the malaria bugs or whatever it is, remain within the spleen. So I did that. That's it. Malaria finished. I was getting it again and again, and practically every 2 months I'd be out for 10 days because I didn't want to take the quinine, because the quinine knocks you out for 30 days. Practically, you're just, So I let the malaria run its course. So, but for instant effect, the allopathic medicines work for malaria. You don't get malaria in Manchester much, only if someone comes back from... Now there are so many more diseases being borne by mosquitoes. There's a new one now. What's it called? Zika? How is that pronounced? I just saw it written.
Zika.
Yeah, so you see, you try to... This trying to destroy all disease by medical means, it's like in the carpet, if there's a little bubble of air, you push it down, but it comes up somewhere else. More diseases come. There's no end to it. Malaria has affected millions of people over the world for years. There's not been much research into malarial antidotes. Why is that? Because there are in Africa, India. You're not going to get much pay. You're not going to get much payback from your research. If you find a drug for counteracting malaria, you need something to counteract diseases that Americans and British get, because they can pay for the expensive drugs. why is there not big research against malaria when millions of people are affected by it every year? That's the reason. They're just all those useless people in India and Africa. Who cares about them? Let them be sick. They're not gonna boost our profits. We're not gonna get a sufficient profit from our investment in research.
What if an initiated devotee catches cancer?
You don't catch cancer. It's not a contagious disease. Yeah.
But he starts taking allopathic medicine.
Mm.
And a time comes when the person just becomes like a cabbage and dies because of the drugs taken again and again. In an unconscious...
Have you seen that in cancer? Chemotherapy is very heavy, but I don't see that people become vegetabilistic, if there's any such word.
There's so much pain that they have to take some medicine.
Oh, I see, yeah. They're in cancer and then they take painkillers, so they become... I've seen a devotee like that. They become as if in a stupor. I would hope that if I get in such a situation, I would rather bear the pain and be conscious, so I can think of Krishna, rather than being in some drug-induced stupor where there's no pain and very little consciousness. Also, I would hope that I would have the courage to do that. Another thing we can pray, Krishna Twadiya Pada Pangaja Panjarantam Adyaiva Me Vishatu Manasa Raja Hangsa Prana Prayana Samaye Kapavata Pittai. And what's the last line? Kantava Rodanam Vidho Smaranam Kutaste. Srila Prabhupada quoted this from Mukunda Mala of Kulashekar. He prays that, let me die now. Better I die now and I'm conscious and I can think of you. The swan of my mind can wrap its... The swan can wrap its neck around the lotus stem of your lotus feet. Rather, because at the time of death, the kapha, pitta and vayu will all be disturbed and will be, I'm in such consciousness, I can't remember you, so better die now, he prays. Srila Prabhupada often quoted that. That's another thought. Anayase maran is stated to be, that's something considered very good. You just quickly die instead of having a long, protracted, lying on the bed in pain. If you suddenly just go, that's considered, that's auspicious. Long on the bed. Srila Prabhupada is on the bed for a long time. Of course, Srila Prabhupada, everything auspicious. He was teaching, as he said to his young disciples at the time, they were young, don't think this won't happen to you. Because when you're young, you can't imagine what it's like to be old. You think you're going to be young forever, right? Yeah, full of health. And well, nowadays all the young people are all sick also. But it used to be that young people were mostly healthy. Anyway, what? So you're saying, better to be injected person, full of drugs?
Yeah, because of the drugs, the person just sleeps and then passes away, dies.
Yeah.
That person go back to Godhead.
That's up to Krishna, isn't it, whether they go back to Godhead or not. It used to be, of course, that people would... Still, I see in India, but it's becoming less common. People just die with dignity. It's becoming uncommon now. Mostly when people are about to die, they take them to hospital, stick a bunch of tubes in them, and then they die. Recently, one of my disciples, his father was dying. He phoned me up and said, can you give a message to him? The doctors say he only has a few days to live. I said, where? He's in the hospital. I said, take him out, bring him home and chant Hare Krishna constantly. In the hospital, they won't allow you to chant Hare Krishna. They're full of drugs and tubes anyway he's going to die and then you'll get a 2-3 lakh bill on top of it. What's the point? Just go. Why go to hospital full of ghosts? Hospitals means they're full of ghosts. So many people die in the hospitals. Go home, surrounded by your loving relatives, and they can all chant for you. That's better. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada, he always said, don't take me to the hospital. I don't want to die in a hospital. I don't want to pass away in a hospital. So it's up to Krishna, but as I see, in not in Western culture, but in at least in India and maybe in other places also, and maybe previously in the West, people would say, "Now my time has come. Now I have to pass on." Even sometimes old people, they apologize. Sorry, I'm causing you so much trouble being alive. I don't have anything more to do in this world. They sometimes pray, God, take me. I have nothing to do here anymore. Just causing trouble to others. So that's passing on with dignity, or dying, let's just say dying. I have all these euphemisms for dying. Dying with dignity, rather than trying to hold on to the last second and get yourself, put tubes in and injections and spending money to try and stay alive. What for? If you have time to go, go. That's what I feel. Maybe that will be tested. If I'm ever in that situation, it will be tested. Will I stick to it? But that's what I think. Anyway, you have to die. So just don't hold on. That's listed as one of the, in Buddhism certainly, and in yoga theory. I'm not talking about this exercise yoga that they call, but one of the illusions, or one of the causes of bondage to this world is clinging to life. being attached to staying in this body. There's a story in the Mahabharata like that, one rishi, he saw there was a worm on the road. And then there was a cart coming which was going to run over the worm, and the worm quickly got out of the way, and the rishi laughed. Maybe, I can't remember, it was a rishi or something. You see the worm, he's just a worm and he's afraid of being killed. And the worm spoke to him and instructed him. And I can't remember what he said exactly, but to the effect that, every living being is attached to their life. Srila Prabhupada pointed out, Srila Prabhupada often used the example of worms in stool. It's a classic example. It means it goes back to the Upanishads. If you take the worm out of stool, he'll crawl back. He won't think, oh, thank you, you took me out of the stool. What are you doing? Come on, this is not fair. Put me back. What time are we supposed to go for Harinam?
No.
Okay, let's go. Is it still raining?
No, it stopped.
Okay, great.
So we need to get Maharaj's bedding, anything you need. Or do you want to come back here first?
Either way, I don't mind.
We come back. If we go till 8:30 or something like that.
Whatever, yeah. Okay, let's go.
Is there
bedding there? Okay. And just bring this yoga mat.
You got a yoga mat?
There is a yoga mat for everyone to use, but it's a little spin mattress and a little fence body.
No, I'm not going to use it.